2009. Today we have the Office of Enterprise Technologies budget before us. Donna, Mr. Lally, welcome back to the Budget Division. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Gopal Khanna. I'm the state CIO with Office of Enterprise Technology. We are a lead agency that's helped guide and direct and set the policies for the IT assets in the executive branch, as well as serves the other government entities. We appreciate your inviting us and in having us come here today to present OET. Before I get started, let me quickly introduce to you a couple of my associates who are here with me, who are going to help us walk through a PowerPoint presentation and some handouts that we have for you this afternoon. To my left is John Lally. He's the Director of Portfolio Management and Planning for Office of Enterprise Technology. I also have here with me, waiting in the wings, Chris Brucey, the Chief Information Security Officer, as well as the CFO of OET, Larry Freund, if the need be. As we look at our presentation this afternoon, I would urge you, Mr. Chairman and members, to see it in the context of today's reality. We as a state and a country are passing through some trying times, and while information technology can provide the advantage to government to become better and streamline and become more effective, we do have a lot of challenges before us. So as our budget was constructed, it had taken into consideration four key principles that I would want you to keep in mind as you proceed further. One is cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is a matter of huge concern to us because it's a real threat. As a matter of fact, there was a report from U.S. CERT, which is a part of Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C., that has shown that the number of malicious attacks, bad attacks that can bring government down, have grown by 40% last year. These are well-organized attacks on our country's assets by individuals as well as nation states. For the first time in the history of the United States, we had a president who stood up at the joint meeting of the Congress and talked about cybersecurity for the first time ever. It's a real threat to the nation, to our state, and to our state's most valuable assets, and that's citizen data. The second context in doing our budget and envisioning what we should be doing over the next couple of years is in the context of the reality that has emerged over the last 20, 25 years of very good innovation that made government very effective through distributed computing. However, that environment today has created huge amount of vulnerabilities for us. We have data centers all over that need to be consolidated, because without that consolidation, we cannot secure the state's government operations. The third component is the reality that more and more citizens want data and information, but they also want accountability and transparency and security. And there's a lot of redundancy when it comes to our web applications, and we need to create an environment whereby it's a productive environment, not only for state government, but also for citizens to be able to access their information, whether it be for licensing or other web-enabled applications. And finally, the fourth piece is information technology has a huge role to play, especially in these trying times, to help streamline the operations of government and make them better and more effective. And as our workforce is retiring, it's that much more important that we plan for the future and start taking actions that will take us there towards a more streamlined, effective, and productive government. Having said that, I would like to pass on now to my associate over here, John Lally, to walk us through some of the details that we have for presentations in four areas: governor's initiatives, the two initiatives that we have before you, our cybersecurity and IT security, and finally our budget. John.
Mr. Lally, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Lally. I'm with the Office of Enterprise Delicious irony when
a technology... Why don't you move one of the mics a little closer? You're kind of off-center, so cutting in and out.
I've been accused of that before, Senator.
Yeah.
There's a delicious irony when technology fails the technology people. I had hoped to use a PowerPoint presentation to walk you through some of the more arcane elements of these recommendations, because they get a little bit complicated. But we couldn't make it work, so I'll do a Fiorello LaGuardia and talk you through it, if I may.
Okay.
The first initiative we're going to talk about is the Data Center Consolidation Initiative, and in your handout, it's on page 2, slide number 4. I hope to leave you with this important message about what's at stake. Today, state government depends on information and the management and protection of that information from whatever sources. It's the raw material of government. It is the product of government. It is the source of many important decisions and has significant impact on all of our constituents and customers. And our stability as a state is only as good as the protection we give to that information to guarantee its integrity and that its accuracy is protected. Our objective with data center consolidation was to create an environment for operating our computer applications and protecting our computer data that is secure, that is reliable and stable so that you can depend on it, that it will keep the really critical components of state government in operating mode. Unfortunately, that's not the case right now. There are many areas of weakness that we have uncovered. In an independent study that's been going on for the last year, we've looked at the data center component of this and found significant deficiencies and exposure to risk that is simply intolerable for state as dependent on technology as we are. When we talk about data centers, I should clarify what we mean. Data centers conjure up an image of rows of humming tape drives and disk drives and computers with lights blinking on and air conditioning and kind of a hushed electronic environment. And we have a couple data centers that look just like that. We have many others that are stuck away in closets or in basements that have water running through the floors, that have wiring that's unsafe, where the rooms are overheated to the point that we put the servers and routers and the other technology components at risk. We have situations where data is not backed up, where applications cannot be restored readily if something happens to them. This is the environment we're operating, and this is what affects, if you look just at the list of information items there, 9/11 operations, criminal records, welfare benefits, tax records, school grants, voter records, vendor payments, and very important state employee payrolls. All of that is dependent on a reliable and accurate processing of information. And the risk to the state of having some of these systems go down is very high, not just financially, but in terms of the human impacts of those systems on our citizens. The third-party data assessment in the next slide that we did is still not quite done. We're refining it more as trying to get additional information largely coming out of the legislative process. We learned 4 important messages out of that data center assessment. Most of our data centers are inadequate for the demands placed on them and are substandard compared to what other states and governments and certainly the private sector would have for similar operations. We are at high risk of losing data and losing program integrity if those systems go down. We lack a disaster recovery capability that is really appropriate for our operating environment. And the IT environment that we're trying to manage is simply too complex to be done efficiently and with due regard for the reliability that we need to have. So I'm going to look at those 4 things in a little more detail if you turn to slide 7 on page 4, please. When we say that most of our data centers are inadequate and substandards, right now the state has dozens of data centers. Depending on where you draw the line between a closet and a data center, we've got probably 36 or more data centers worthy of the name scattered across 32 buildings in state government. The industry standard for data centers that run programs comparable to the most important ones that we run in state government is what's called a Tier 3 data center. That's a data center that has redundant power and data feeds, is highly secure, is protected against natural disasters, and is backed up. Tier system runs from Tier 1, which is a basic data center, and that's what most of our good data centers are, up to Tier 4, which would be like an airline reservation system or a national defense data system or something like that. Many of our data centers are so inadequate that we can't call them Tier 1. We'd have to call them Tier 0 to be accurate. We have, in addition, almost 70,000 square feet of owned space or leased space that's dedicated to data centers, which is about three times larger than we would need if we would consolidate and virtualize servers. And you'll forgive the lay definition. Virtualized servers means you go from having stacks and stacks and stacks of boxes running data to larger servers that partition off their memory into smaller components. They're much more stable and much more cost-efficient and much easier to back up. If we can go to an environment where we consolidate the data centers, consolidate servers, virtualize our server environment, and go to more common shared standards around those data centers, we can reduce that square footage by a substantial amount and have much higher quality in the process. Many of our current data centers are not designed to be data centers. They are office space or manufacturing space that was retrofitted and simply are inadequate for security and the reliability they need. And none of them, without exception, including the most recent ones, meet the green IT standards for environmental sensitivity and efficiency that are now mandated. They simply cannot be retrofitted to work well in that respect. The second finding, we are at high risk of losing data and programs, gets to the nature of the quality of that environment within those data centers. Many of them have unreliable power and data. If you have a construction accident and it cuts a power cable, there's no immediate shift over to another data feed or another power feed, and the system goes down. And it might go down for a few hours, it might go down for a few days. But ask yourself if some of these mission-critical systems were down for a week or 2 weeks while it's being restored, what would be the impact on some of the programs that serve our citizens? In some cases, it could be extremely devastating. Many of our buildings are vulnerable to storms, to floods, to accidents of any kind. The state's primary data center, the Centennial Office Building, is on the fifth floor of a building with a history of leaky roofs. It's in the flight path for a local airport, and it's next to the laboratories in the Department of Health and Department of Agriculture, and probably next to one of the most high-profile targets for mischief, which is the State Capitol Building. This is not where you would put a data center if you had an option. We're looking to move our primary data center off campus to find a location that is more secure and able to withstand any of these kinds of challenges. In addition, as Chris Boozy will talk to you about in a few moments, and as Gopal mentioned, many of our data centers are vulnerable to both cyber and physical security breaches simply because the more instances you have of the servers and operating systems and the physical plants, the more likely that somebody can find a way into one of them. They can get in physically and do a lot of damage to the databases, or they can get in electronically. The results can be catastrophic on the applications and data files. Everything ranging from at the most benign, putting stuff into the system that is embarrassing, to criminal or interfering with everything from medical approvals to routing of emergency traffic. Many of these sites have been built up over time. Nobody sat down to design inadequate services, but we have become so dependent on computers at such an accelerated rate in recent years that they've simply overwhelmed the financial and physical assets that we have available to make those data centers what they need to be. The third learning that we had from this study is that we lack business continuation capability, or as it used to be called, and I think more aptly, disaster recovery capability. Most of our data centers and applications that run in those data centers do not have a comprehensive recovery plan that is documented. They may have contingency plans, but they really aren't the quality that can guarantee they can continue operations with minimal interference. Most of them that do have such plans have not recently tested them in a real-world environment where you actually take a data system offline and see how long it takes to restore the ability of that data center to do its job. The independent experts that we hired, looking at the profile of our data centers and looking at the history of our data centers, where we have had everything from floods to fires to electrical interruptions, predict a major data center failure in the coming 3 years. They can't say which one, but the odds are, the statistics are, the national trends support that data centers configured like ours are going to have a major failure, and it's just a matter of time. We've been very lucky. We have not lost a major data center as other private entities and public entities have. But luck is not a strategy you can count on for the long term. The fourth finding was that our IT environment is simply too complex to manage efficiently and reliably. We have over 3,000 physical servers, and a physical server can be something as simple as a box like this or a blade server, or it might be something more akin to the mini computers of a few years ago. We have 3,000 different ones in operation running data and applications for all of the state's business. There are more than 250 different models of servers, and each model has its own unique characteristics and requires its own separate maintenance to support. We have 85 different operating systems. Many of them are custom operating systems, and they're obsolete. They're not even supported by the people that originally sold them. And most troubling, half of the servers that we have in service in state government right now will have reached the end of life, which is a designation when you can expect significant failure, will have reached end of life by the end of this calendar year, the end of 2009. Half of them. So we spent a lot of time looking at the situation, and the conclusions we came up with are on slide 11. Doing nothing, just continuing to hope that prayer and luck will get us through this process is simply not enough. There's too much at risk for our citizens and for our government. We have to do something now that is aggressive, will get us into a better situation so that our data will be safe and our business systems will be up and running. We also know we can't afford to fix them individually, agency by agency, site by site, and then I'll show you the metrics on that in just a moment. It has to be a shared solution to give us the redundancy we need and the protection we need to keep our data centers safe. The slide on the chart on slide 12 doesn't come across monochrome very well, but I'll try to describe what it's telling you.
But before I start going the options, Sarah Pappas, do you have a question on what we've covered so far?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if you're taking questions.
Sure. I think this is a nice breaking point before I start getting what the options are. So,
Mr. Lally, Mr. Chairman, wouldn't centralization create more vulnerability? Because if you have everything in one spot, and if there would be some kind of failure at that one spot, then you wipe out all your systems.
If, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, yes, absolutely, if we didn't have the backup capabilities, the redundancy, because then you would have a site that would be prepared to take up an individual server or the entire data center itself, a combination of sites where that functionality would transfer immediately if there was an incident. So what our strategy is to create the central data site and then maintain the best of the remaining data centers to be the backup sites for that one, so you have mutual support at all times.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lally, who were these independent experts? Did you say that at the beginning and I came in late and missed it?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I'm sorry, no, I did not. The company we engaged is Excipio. Excipio is one of the...
Spell that?
E-X-C-I-P-I-O. They are one of the major players in a niche that looks at data center management and trends and disaster recovery and all that. They're one of the best in the country. They're used by most of the major corporations in America.
Madam Chair, do they have any ties to any potential vendors?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, in the IT industry, almost everybody has ties. They subcontract with various people in different packages. I suspect they probably have subcontract ties. To my knowledge, they're an independent company. They're not a subsidiary of any other corporation.
And so, Mr. Chairman, just one more, and then I think we could go on, is just to I just wanted you to reiterate that in spite of all these problems, we have not lost anything. We haven't had any accidents. We haven't had any cyber breaches or some minor.
Chairman,
no
Senator
major.
Pappas, Senator Pappas, we have had breaches. We have had accidents and incidents. We've had data centers that have flooded out. Centennial Building, the basement of the Centennial Building, where part of our operation is located, flooded out 2 years ago. We've had issues in many different data sets. You normally don't hear about them because there's an emergency effort to try to restore them, and they will be brought up, and usually there's not a lot of public fanfare, partly because the idea is that nobody will notice if they go down, and partly because we don't want to draw attention to the deficiencies that we have. But there have been episodes. Minsky had other state agencies have had significant outages in the last couple of years at critical times. They've managed to recover the application, recover the data, but it was often a Herculean effort to do so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be useful to have a list of those to make your case.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I will try to provide that to you.
Okay. I'll hold the rest of my questions.
Well, let's, and then any other questions up to this point? Okay, well, let's talk about the options, Mr. Lally.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, and by the way, I do welcome questions at any point in this. This is complicated, and I hope to try to bring you along to that.
Well, it seemed that, you know, that was a breaking point between, you know, where we've been and what we're going, so I figured that would be nice, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, one of the things we started to look at is what is both the cost profile and the effectiveness of upgrading in place, going around to our major data centers and creating from a tier zero or tier one site, a tier two or three level site that we could rely on and provide the backup. And we found, as you will see, that it was an extraordinarily expensive proposal. And just to maintain a current level, not to create a situation in the future where we'd be able to build on that. If you look at the table on slide 12, the top two lines talk about the risk exposure and the cost of upgrading the data centers. And as you can see, it's a substantial number. The bottom lines, which are dealing with the cost for a new data center, take us to the opposite extreme, where we invest in a new data center and migrate from most of the data centers, their applications and data files, their servers and routers and all the other paraphernalia that make up a data center, into those consolidated data centers with the redundancy we need to provide for business continuation. The next slide summarizes what those options played out for in our deliberations. The first one is always an option. We can do nothing. Unfortunately, we've been doing nothing for far too many years. The risk of significant service interruption is simply too high, and the consequences of that too severe to keep going that way. We can continue to go as we have and fix the issues site by site, and that was the line on the previous chart that goes the highest. We could delay building a new data center, make some selective fixes, and try to bring most of the systems up to a level where they can support one another, but that also still doesn't get rid of most of the risks for business continuation. You end up spending a lot of money, and at the end, you still don't have the situation where you need to be. And the fourth option, which was to consolidate those data centers, move towards virtual servers, move towards the kind of technologies that are present in many states and most private sector corporations, sharing the cost of those sites across all of the agencies in state government and bringing the immediate price tag down considerably from what it would cost for the remodeling. And the next table is looking at the initial two options that we started with last fall when we started to put the budget initiative together. To upgrade the current sites over the next 10 years would cost us $345 million. And I'll be happy to walk through the line costs on that if you would like. But the significant comparison is to if we started from scratch building a new data center, and this was assuming at that point that we were bonding for state-owned property, would be $257 million, almost $100 million in savings over that 10-year. And it as you go out further and further and further, where the cost would mount to replace those existing data centers, the picture gets even more significantly in favor of building a new data center.
Now, we did hear a presentation in this budget division, and you were present for that, where some private vendors came in and said, we can also provide data centers, and we can take it over, and obviously they're not going to do it for free, but they can do it. In any of your cost estimates, did you consider that as a possibility to have a Unisys or IBM or some other company just take over those?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Outsourcing is a very useful tool in certain circumstances. The state, for example, outsources the management of its wide area networks. MinNet is essentially leased capacity from the private sector that we use for all of the state's networks in higher ed and government and local government aids because it makes more sense for us not to be in that business. Much of the development that takes place of new applications is essentially outsourced to development firms that you bring in. You manage the development with your cadre of agency staff, but you bring the talent in you need for the length of time you need it and then let it go. Many private sector companies in a few major jurisdictions have outsourced, as the city of Minneapolis did, their entire data center operation, but it's usually not done to save money. Because the information that we have is that it doesn't save money. What it does is clarify your mission, allow you to upgrade, and essentially get the management of information off your table so that you're going about your other state functions. And I think if I recall when Lynn was up here, when the CIO from the city of Minneapolis was up here, she made very clear that their primary objective was to get that stable environment and to not deal with all the problems of managing data centers for the city of Minneapolis. If you read, as we follow fairly religiously, magazines like Governing and CIO and talk to our colleagues at the National Association of State Chief Information Officers and talk to our peers in the private sector, many of the organizations that went to a managed service function are beginning to move backwards, back to controlling it themselves, because over the long haul, the costs for running your own shop tend to be lower. It's not a given. Every case is different, and that's why I was gratified to hear all the speakers at that last meeting were talking about the need to do a business analysis and look at your specific requirements, because the case for or against data center privatization, outsourcing, is very much dependent on the nature of your environment. In state government, at least in Minnesota and in a couple of other states we've talked to, because of the incredible complexity of our applications and the way that so many of those applications are dependent on custom programming and fairly unique environments, it's going to cost us a lot more to go to an outsourced situation than it might have been somebody who has a more generic operating environment for their systems. It's not a bad or a good business strategy. It's just one that has to be selected with a careful eye to what your requirements are and what the costs are going to be. We have got some information that we're coming, looking at the outsourcing requirements, what that would take. We'll have that information hopefully within the next 2 weeks. It's not a simple task to go out and get an accurate estimate on doing something like that because you really have to get into the details of what your requirements are going to be.
Yes, Sir Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, another concern I would have would be, who owns the equipment, who owns the software, who owns the data? And if you decide that this is you want to change vendors, how you know, how stuck are you, you know, if it's not doing the job for you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, that can be a consideration. That's why there are so many different flavors of outsourcing. For example, our proposal, the governor's proposal, is to lease the data center, but all of the equipment and all of the operations going in it and the staff managing it would be state staff as they are right now. But we're just getting a facility much more quickly and inexpensively than we could build it for ourselves. The other is a turnkey operation where you turn everything over to a vendor. And in that situation, which is often very appealing, particularly if you have a very old but very simple environment, is that you can just get into that very quickly and cheaply, but your costs escalate over time, of course. The issue of protecting data has little to do with who runs the boxes, because the same requirements in law and the same consequences for violating data privacy and so on exist for the private vendor that exists for state employees. If we contract out any service, as, for example, the wide area network service, the people that have access to information flowing over those lines are governed by the same laws that our employees are. So it becomes one of the reasons why your service level agreements have to be so detailed and so precise, so there's no misunderstanding and no issues around who has the freedom to do what. But there's many different flavors of outsourcing.
So when you're talking about some of the costs, as you will, this is not talking about any kind of outsourcing or private vendors. These are just the costs that you anticipate if the state did it. I just want to make sure that I understand what your numbers are.
What the numbers that we have that we're working with now are predicated on a couple of assumptions. One of those assumptions is that the facility and the power maintenance and all of that will go to whoever the vendor is that would win that contract, which might be a private company, it might be public-private corporation, it might be a redevelopment authority. It really doesn't matter to us. We're agnostic about that. But that we would run the operation, and it would be state equipment and running state data and state applications. There are variations on that you'd be able to do, but that's what our plan is.
Yes, sir, Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering if the deal we had with the St. Paul Port Authority to build the new, I think it's the health department that they built, if that's kind of a similar model. I assume that's still kind of a leasing arrangement with Port Authority.
I get a little out of my league, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, when I start talking about leasing arrangements. That's not my specialty. We are working very closely with Department of Administration and the Department of Management and Budget around those financial kinds of opportunities, and I'm assuming they're going to find the best deal they can for us. But in concept, that is exactly what is the kind of thing. We find somebody who has a facility or will build a facility and lease it back to us for a 10-year period of time, and whether we get into lease with an option to buy or lease purchase, that doesn't matter from our standpoint. That'll be the decision for those agencies to deal with. But the end result is still the same. We have a good facility, and we have it soon, which eliminates our exposure to these risks, and have it in a way that's financially attractive.
Okay. Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking back to the other option that Minneapolis is using, and I don't know if this would be a possibility or not, but they were talking about the need for not only having a secure facility building-wise, of course, but the security is mainly that we need is mainly in other areas, but that you have to have a very temperature-controlled facility. And there's other requirements when you're running a lot of computer equipment that are very important to keep it operating at its peak level. Have you checked to see if any of the big companies in our area would have you not gotten that far or looked into it to see if any of them would have capacity to serve as a data center if we could lease from them without maybe doing all the other components of it, or maybe they wouldn't even be interested in it. But I'm just thinking if they had capacity, maybe they would be willing to look at it.
Mr. Lally?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, we are looking at that. That we have Excipio looking right now at what is available in the market. A couple of things. First of all, it has to be away from the Capitol complex. Ideally, it would be 20 to 30 to 40 miles away from the data complex so that you have sufficient separation that a tornado or other cataclysmic event like that doesn't take out your primary data center and your backup data center. So, yes, we are looking at options that range from co-location with somebody who has space and will make it available, providing it's flexible enough that as if we get into some of the other kind of arrangements that I'll talk about in a moment, it can be expanded without great cost to us. And we get into issues of doing due diligence around the stability of the company and all the physical requirements of the facility as well, because we have to keep all of those at the same level as if it was our own data center. So, yes, that information is there was an RFI request for information that was out on the street and came in, I believe, about a week ago, and it's being analyzed right now, looking at just those kind of possibilities.
Any other questions? Okay, well, please proceed.
Our initial recommendation last summer was that the state should bond for and build a new state-owned data center to consolidate the servers, giving us some advantages of ownership and security and the state-of-the-art facility we need. The recommendation that came back from the governor's office was a modification of that and asked that we look at a lease option. And there are a couple of different reasons why that is done. Putting aside things like bond capacity and what the markets are and what the competition is for those bonding dollars, this lets us acquire the property much more quickly than we would be able to if we had to go through the typical bonding cycle of pre-design, design, construction, money, and then the actual construction of the data center. And bear in mind, if that's a 3 or 4 year process, we're at risk all through that process. It also eliminates some of the cost inflation that typically goes with delaying a project for 3 or 4 years, which can be 5 to 6% a year easily, even in the current economic environment. So the recommendation was that we pursue a lease arrangement for this new data center, and that's what is in the bill, and that's what the economics proposal are tied to. When we're done with that, we will have a facility that has stronger disaster recovery capabilities. It's not going to be perfect because there's still a lot of documentation and testing that's going to have to go on, but it'll certainly be better than what we have now by a significant amount. And that goes with the greatly reduced risk of failure due to flooding of a basement data center or a leaky roof or a fire or a traffic accident where somebody goes through this wall into your data center. We will have more stable and higher performing systems because by their nature these centralized systems with their consolidation and virtualization run better. They are more efficient. They get higher performance for the dollar. We'll be in a facility that is more appropriate for the importance of the applications running on it. We'll have equipment that is modernized and will be on a replacement cycle, unlike the current run them till they break cycle, which incurs a lot of other costs and risks associated with it. We'll have easier maintenance and better quality of operations supporting all the applications that run on those, which will have benefits down the road as we get into replacement and maintenance because it'll be a more simplified environment. And it'll be a more green environment, and one of the things that makes the economics of this work is the higher efficiency, the higher energy efficiency of the data centers we're proposing. The summary of this, of what we're proposing, is on page 17. The assets, which are in our parlance the boxes, the things that hurt when they fall on your foot, and all the systems and data that run on those boxes will be owned by the departments themselves or by OET, depending on the service level agreement that we come up with. The building itself will be owned by that external provider, whoever that might be. The facility staffing, again, maintenance and cleaning and all that sort of thing, would probably be done by the external provider. The operations staffing, the people that run the programs and install the hardware and software and manage the data, would be state staff just as they are right now. The next slide on page 18, on slide 18, I'm not going to walk through that. It gets pretty technical, but what you ought to look at is what's in the column called current and the column called future, and look at the differences between those. Going from 69,000 square feet of space to 20,000, going from 267 servers, makes and models and numbers actually a little higher than that, to 30 to 50, reducing the number of physical servers, reducing their age, reducing the number of operating systems, increasing disaster recovery compliance, increasing the quality of the data spaces, reducing the number of locations, and going to a true 7x24 operation that will support citizen services without regard to time and space. All of those are the hallmarks of what we'll have with the new consolidated data center that we cannot do effectively with our current environment. Now the money, what's in the initiative? The governor's initiative is for $16.5 million in change and change over the next 2 years. Year one is largely around planning and preparation for the move, for equipping the new data center and managing the migration of applications and hardware and data from existing data centers to the new data center. And that is something that's it's very complicated and very complex, but it's something that we do routinely in state government. It also covers the first-year lease of that facility at no cost to the agencies that have data center right now. Second year, the budget covers the marginal cost, which will be higher over time, the marginal cost for the new data center, because you're moving from a very inexpensive office space into a highly professional data center environment, and the costs are going to be higher. But it buys the agencies a year's time to budget for that and plan for that and deal with how they're going to deal with the existing data center space that they're giving up, if in fact they are giving up their data centers. Because again, some of them under this scenario, the best of the new ones will serve as the backup for the main data center. That initiative turns out to be, in fiscal year 2010, $11,725,000. $4.3 million of that is this one-time startup expense that I'll talk about in a second on the next slide. The $7,425,000 is half, 6 months, the estimate for the data center lease. In 2011, fiscal 2011, that $4,810,000 that we're requesting is that $14,850,000 annual lease cost, as best we can estimate it now, less the $10 million and change that agencies currently pay in rent for private or public space for their data centers. So this is, again, buying them that time to prepare for that in the budget. The lease costs total that will be expended is $22 million, of which approximately $11 or $12 million of that comes out of the initiative, and the balance comes out of existing agency budgets. In the future, the agencies would pay for that rental space just as they would now, either through rates paid to OET or the Department of Administration, whose ever count is managing this, and will be handled as it is right now.
One question I've got: if we were not to have this budget deficit that we're facing and these problems, and we're just coming up with a straight up proposal, just saying, well, the need is there, we're going to have to consolidate these data centers, and we need to do it in the next couple of years, and let's pay for it now. What would the upfront cost be right now if we were trying to do it now, as opposed to spreading it out over 10 years?
Can I postpone answering that, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman,
for
one more slide?
Okay.
And then I can.
Well, and then the other question we're going to have is, if we spread it out over 10 years, we're going to have to look at, how was that cost compared to just paying up front, and are we going to be paying for something after its life expectancy is over? That's something we ought to have to worry about, too. So,
Mr. Chairman, you're right.
Why don't you go ahead, and maybe you'll get to it then. So, okay.
Slide
20.
On this
slide, number 20, I'm still not quite understanding. I mean, you mentioned the quality of the space is improving, but it does seem like that's a big change, because even though the square feet is going from 69,000 to 20,000, the total cost is going up 4.8 million because of the leasing cost. I mean, what? You'd think that it would at least be a wash because you're consolidating so much space.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, it would be nice if it was a revenue-neutral proposal, but in fact, the cost for a Tier 3 data center is substantially higher than the office space rate that people are paying right now, because the amortization of those costs is a big cost. The operating cost for the electrical, which is one of the biggest costs for a data center, is an electrical and in the cooling capacity to keep it at an air-conditioned level. This will be much higher cost per square foot to operate this data center than it would be for operating typical office space. But that's the nature of the data center characteristics, is that it has all of this redundancy built in that we currently don't have. It has dual data feeds or backup feeds. If a generator goes in a Tier 3 data center that backs up your power feed, you've got a backup generator. So that you just have continuous operations without those kinds of interruptions. So it is a very significant uptick in the cost per square footage for those space and in the utilities associated with it, very much higher than you might expect. Mr. Chairman, remember slide 21 is that $4.3 million that I mentioned. It's the upfront money. And this is just to give you a breakdown of how that money is going to be spent. We can go through it in as much or as little detail as you want, but some of it goes for consulting assistance, some of it goes for hardware, some of it is the actual physical relocation of these existing data centers, hardware and equipment to move into the new data center. Some of it is for the tools to manage that data center centrally rather than manage it decentralized basis in three dozen different locations. The 4.3 number, we're confident, will create that professional environment and manage the cost of the moves to the new data center. The number, Mr. Chairman, that I think you're looking for is in slide 22. Now, the numbers that I'm giving you here look at what we thought would be the best options. We do not have numbers yet for you for an outsourcing, a comprehensive outsourcing option, which is everything goes to the private sector. And we don't have an option here for what happens if we bond and build a state building rather than lease or lease to purchase. We'll have those numbers for you as soon as we can get them. But part of what has been happening with the changing in the economic environment is that those are not static numbers anymore. So we're trying to come up with the most current ones we can. Our current state, the average yearly cost, as best we can predict it, is in that circled number at the bottom. It's going to cost $9.9 million just to operate the current data centers we have in state government, those 36 different data centers. That includes the central facility in the Centennial Building, data centers in all of the major agencies, some agencies that share data centers, all the way down to a 500-square-foot room in an office building that somebody has.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. That's what we're going to be paying. If we do nothing, that's the cost that we would assume.
That's the cost effectively today. If you look at the numbers up there for the capital costs, servers, data center, and power, that's what it costs us to run those data centers today.
Okay, Senator Pappas.
But Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lally, that's not one budget item. Are those costs are embedded across all state agencies?
Yeah, Mr. Lally?
Chairman, yes, Senator Pappas, that's correct. And they're in different lines in the budgeting process, depending on whether it's a state-owned facility or in a private lease. It's no small task trying to identify those costs. This does not include labor, by the way. This does not include the cost of the people running those data centers.
Close to the 300 data centers you're talking about, this is the cost overall to run them today. Is that what you're
to run approximately three dozen data centers. There's actually 60 or so that are called data centers, but most of them are glorified closets.
Gotcha.
To reduce the risk in the current space, not to eliminate it, not to put them into the professional category that we've been talking about, but just to upgrade them to the point where they can continue operations, is a $28 million charge over the next 5 years. To lease a data center, and again, none of these include labor costs, but to lease that data center and equip it and operate it for those next 5 years is $14.8 million a year, which is an increase over the current amount, but about half of what it would cost to upgrade them to the point where we would be comfortable with them. And that upgrade does not give us the redundancy and the protection that we need for those systems. And that's the basic model we have right now. We will have more information on the outsourcing option, and we do an infinite variety of scenarios here, but these are the big ones that we've had to look at. What we are doing right now is proceeding along a path as if you approve this, because we can't afford the time loss to wait until May or June to proceed with that. So we're working right now with the Department of Administration on facility strategy. We're doing planning around the migration of these data centers. We're doing planning around what the operation in the new data center is going to be like. We're involved deeply in discussions with the other agencies that are involved about how this would handle be happening. The leasing and management options, again, we will be deferring to our more prepared colleagues in the Department of Administration on that. We're also beginning to work on developing a services catalog and a costing model for the operation of this data center. And we are starting already to begin consolidating of servers and storage and data centers where it's possible to do without a major capital investment. And all of these things are starting now because the lead time to do this would not make it feasible to accomplish it within the period that's anticipated in the biennial budget document. There are some major questions that we don't have answers to yet. Our options regarding existing data centers, the specific migration and lease costs, right now we're working with a set of heuristics, a set of generalized costs based on locations like this and systems like this. We have to get very specific what migration order we're going to be moving the data centers in, who's going to move into whose equipment is new enough, modern enough, that they can just move it versus have to move into new equipment to replace stuff that is not adequate for its purpose. We have not yet made a decision on which of the existing data centers will be used as the backup centers. Several of them are new and in quite good shape, but they don't have the capacity individually to serve that purpose. But two or three of them collectively could provide that backup capability, and we want to look at that. The time frame, the hoped for time frame, is that we will be in a new facility next January, which would not be possible probably in a bonding situation, but that begins to reduce our risk profile and help us control the costs. And then the migration would take place the second half of this coming fiscal year and the following fiscal year, and that's what's reflected in the bond.
Mr. Lally, I'm just trying to clarify one or a couple of things here, and then I'll certainly take other questions here. I'm looking at the budget book, page 8 and 9, which also reflect the numbers that you have here, where the proposal is in fiscal year 2010 to paying $11.725 million for the data center consolidation in 2010, and then 2011, $4.8 million for that. At the bottom of your slide on page 20, it says one-year lease estimate for $14.850 million. So, I mean, in the future, are we going to be booking this $14 million after these startup costs in 10 and 11, or what is the state's cost going to be down the road if we do this? How much do we pay each year, and how for how long?
Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, the numbers are going to be as reflected in here. That's what we expect to have
in here. In
the 14.796, actually, which is okay. A refinement of the original number that went in the budget as we got more information. So we're looking at an average yearly cost over the next 5 years of $14.796 million to operate data centers.
$14.796 for 5 years, and that's
per year for 5 years.
Is that including 10 and 11, or is that after 10 and 11?
That's after 10 and 11.
Okay.
Well, so, I'm sorry, that includes 10 and 11. They're part of what's budgeted here, but it would be going beyond that.
Okay, so actually the $16 million for the next biennium starts it up, includes this $14 million, and after that it's $14 million a year? Is that what it is?
That's the best estimate we have right now.
Okay, so for 5 years after this biennium, it's 14.796, which would include this biennium and 5 years after that.
Correct.
Okay. And so that's a seven-year period, and so it's $28 million for each biennium then after that? If it's 14 point each year?
So round numbers, yes.
Okay, it's $28 million per biennium, which is actually about the cost instead of just fixing what we've got right now, is about $28 million. If I understood, you on page, you slide on 22, you said $28 million.
$28 million is an equivalent number to the 14. It's $28 million, Mr. Chairman, annually. For fixing up what we have versus
annually,
14.7 annually.
I see, okay.
But those are average estimates.
Gotcha, okay. Okay.
The other piece that is part of this that is, as I mentioned, is not unknown. The agencies right now are leasing existing data center space. They've got to deal with, are they going to, it's called decommission or recommission space, convert it into office space, let go of it, modify their leases. That's going to vary dramatically from agency to agency. So there will be some differences, some differing impact on each agency that we won't know until the final decisions are made about relocation. In some cases, they can give up that space. In other cases, they'll have to absorb it as office space.
Senator Pappas, did you have a question?
Well, I'm just thinking about the difficulty of our budget division being able to accomplish this when the current cost is spread over all of state government. Does that include Minsky, too,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, no. This includes merely the executive branch. Does not include Minsky or the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure if it includes some of the, like, Metropolitan Council, although we currently host the Metropolitan Council in our existing data center. I should also tell you that there are some other complications that we're looking at in this. We are involved in discussions right now with the state of Wisconsin about mutual redundancy. Their primary data center might be our backup data center instead of having the distributed ones, and then we would in turn be their backup data center. Wisconsin has a Tier 4 data center, which is the highest level, higher than we think is necessary. We are also having discussions with several counties who are interested in having that same kind of shared facility, and are also involved in discussions with Minsky, because this is a situation where centralization yields some significant efficiencies for everybody involved, providing you have the backup capability so that you can prevent major disruption to all of them involved. But all of these right now are at the speculative stages. We've been talking to them. There's a lot of interest in that. The RFI that the RFP that we would put out would include sufficient ability to expand so that we don't get in a position where those kind of partnerships cause us to have to spend extra money that we otherwise wouldn't. So we would be building the data center in a modular fashion that could make that sort of partnering arrangement be to our mutual benefit. But this, just to be clear, this proposal is just looking at the executive branch of Minnesota. All those other things are maybe on the horizon and maybe not.
Sir Pappas, follow
up. So, Mr. Chairman, so ultimately, like right now, you said chargeback at one point.
Mm-hmm.
So are these costs going to be charged back to the agencies? Or is the expectation that one central entity, i.e. our budget division, would give you the money to provide this service and the agencies wouldn't be charged for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I don't know how that's going to work, and it depends on what the business arrangement we have out of this process is. if it's a chargeback basis, if OET acts as the, if you will, the primary occupant, and we lease the space, sublease it, or make it available to the agencies, it would go through the rate process. It would be paid back to us. If it's like most space, it's managed by the Department of Administration, the payments would go to them. The difficulty becomes in the transitions as we move to where OET manages the data center capabilities on behalf of the agency. It's more than a real estate transaction at that point. Then we're into operating expenses and service level agreements. So I'm dancing around this because I don't really know what it will end up being. It'll probably be a mix at the beginning. If a major agency wants to occupy the space and run their own servers, in the long term that doesn't make sense, but in the short term it might make sense. We just don't know all those details yet.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lally, you made mention that there may be a redundancy infrastructure in the state of Wisconsin. When we have data privacy rules and laws established to protect information, we can only enforce that law in our state. Once we transfer that information beyond our borders, then we as a state cannot enforce the privacy rights of our citizens. Has there been any discussion of how that data would be protected under law in a different state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, that is done routinely under contractual obligations. Anybody that takes on the responsibility for our data in whatever form and for whatever purpose takes on all the liability as if it was running and housed in Minnesota. For example, right now your internet connections here are probably owned by somebody out of state running on hardware out of state, but any data privacy requirements that we have when we set up a contract for that capacity include all the controls and all the constraints and all the penalties associated with law for anybody using that. They're acting as our contract agent. They're covered by the laws that cover us.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Limmer.
I had always thought that maybe a civil law violation might follow, but I had never thought that if a crime had occurred in some other jurisdiction other than Minnesota, Minnesota would not be able to enforce its at least written into its statute books, the law, because it didn't occur here in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, you may be right when it comes to the criminal. I'm speaking primarily of the civil penalties that are involved with this. If the information is misused, we would have to pursue that with the local jurisdictions, I believe. But I'm not an attorney, and I'm certainly not an expert on criminal law.
And Mr. Lally, has there been any discussion from a qualitative standpoint of the protection that the state of Wisconsin gives its citizens' data in relationship to what Minnesota does? Do they enforce similar law? Is it the same way, both civil and criminal? Is the criminal evidentiary standard the same?
Chairman, Senator Limmer, I can't answer that authoritatively. I don't know. But what you also need to understand is when they run our backup resource, and it doesn't matter whether it's running in Rochester or Rochester, New York, we would control access to the data through our security systems. We would control access to the applications through our security systems. All they're doing is providing a box in a building, and that operation does not give them access to the information that's controlled in that. In most of our In many of our applications, that information cannot be accessed without access to the security system, which controls the identity management and authorization management that controls what you are able to do if you have physical possession of that information. That's true no matter where that goes.
Yes, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, if this bill continues to make progress this year, I'd like to get some evidence that the department has discussed some of these issues that I brought up.
Well, so far there's no bill, but you know, this is the governor's proposal so far. We hope to see bills soon. So, yeah, Mr. Lally.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'll try to get somebody who knows more about the law in this area than I am to respond to your question. I'm sorry, I just don't have that information.
Mr. Chair, I think most of our discussion has been on kind of the quantity of the budget on this proposal, the hardware required, but then I'm not sure how much of the qualitative element to this discussion in relationship to how it fits into our data privacy law interacts with it, and that would be critical for the quality of the system to be reaffirmed with our legislative members before we vote on it.
Well, presumably, Senator Limmer, you know, if and when a bill is introduced on behalf of the administration, it would have to go through the normal policy channels before it gets to the Finance Committee and this Budget Division, so that those issues could be fleshed out, you know, in the appropriate committees. But you know, we're running out of time to be doing that stuff. So,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, if I might, I'll use an example, a homegrown example, where we don't have the issues of jurisdiction and geography. Our data center on top of the Centennial Office Building runs very many applications that have highly sensitive data around human services and taxation and a lot of other areas. But you can't go into the computer and just access that information. That's controlled by access control. It's controlled by the security systems. The same consequences would happen if somebody went in there and started grazing on information on one of our boxes as it would if the box was located in Madison, Wisconsin. And that is the kind of issue that we are very concerned about. And do violations of that occur? I suspect they have. I don't know of any. Most of the violations of data privacy that I'm aware of in my 30 years in state government have had to do with somebody going in and looking at a physical document they shouldn't, or sitting at a terminal to which they had access legally, but doing things they shouldn't have done. In most of the modern systems that are developed now, you have access tracking that says this person, identified through the access management system, performed this function on this record at this time and on this date. And you run audit trails and examinations on those data files routinely to figure, are there patterns here? Do you have people doing things or attempting to do things that they have no right to do? Am I going in and looking at some celebrity's tax records? Got no business to do that. Am I looking at my ex-spouse's benefits that they're entitled to? I've got no business doing that just because I'm a state employee. And the typical response of an agency to something like that is termination and, in some cases, further action after that. That's what the law exists to protect the information about our citizens.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Limmer.
I'm glad you brought this element up because, you know, we the legislature have been discussing things in recent years regarding Real ID, where we have to share data based on federal edict to share data, and that members of other bureaucracies in other states would have access to our citizens' records. And we now have, in the most recent stimulus package in Washington, where now medical records across the nation are going to have to be held in a central depository in Maine. And those bring up these same security issues. And so I guess data privacy is a timely issue, no matter when we bring it up, now that we've entered this brave new world of computer progress. But it seems like every year we keep having to share our data outside of the borders of the state of Minnesota, and I think we lose control. And I'm a little, as much as you need a redundancy plan, I'm not sure if I'm sold on the idea that it should be outside of the state, even regardless of cost.
But Mr. Chairman,
we can discuss
Limmer.
That later. But.
Yeah, your points are well taken.
Okay. Anything further on the data center consolidation?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
This is the Is this the plan that the realtors had concern?
No, the next one. Next item, e-licensing is the one, and they want to testify, and they will be given that opportunity. But right. that's the next issue is the one they want. Just as a note, I doubt that anybody's going to come to me and say, I've got $17 million extra to spend for data consolidation. If I have to do it, it's probably going to have to come out of our current budget, and we've already seen everybody's had a proposed 5% budget cut so far. By my quick math indicates to me that's about, $31 million or whatever, just on those issues alone. So I'd have to come up with even more cuts just to pay for this if I have to do it out of this one. And I may be told I have to have greater cuts, so I don't know. So I don't know where the money's going to come from, but we'll see how things look in a day or so. So, Mr. Lally, did you want to move on to the next topic? So,
Mr. Chairman, just...
Yeah, Sir Pappas.
You touched upon just fleetingly the issue of bonding dollars. What would be the... You mentioned the limitations if we went through the usual kind of bonding cycle, but what if we could accelerate that? Would bonding dollars be available, or does that not really help us because... Your plan is already a leasing, having someone else build the building and then leasing.
Mr. Lally?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, I can't speculate on the availability of the bonding dollars or the desirability.
No, I'm not asking for the availability. I'm asking for the would it be possible to use that source?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, you can do that. Certainly the process of building a building like a data center, if you did it like we did the Revenue Department building, which was design-build rather than the traditional pre-designed design construction money, can cut quite a bit of time off that. It won't cut enough time off so that this package, as it currently exists, would be feasible. We couldn't make those kind of deadlines. As to whether it's economically advisable, I'll defer that to my colleagues.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that kind of answering my own question in that really the problem is the operating costs here.
Mr. Chairman, we're very much aware of the problems that this division has to deal with for many of the utility kinds of applications of state government. They serve multiple agencies outside of your budget area. The costs are incurred in other areas, and we know they come to rest here. I wish I could fix that, but it's a little outside my turf as well. We are advancing a proposal that needs to be advanced to address a problem that needs to be resolved. I wish I could find a better way of doing that. I just don't have that ability to do that.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the chairman and others need to have a conversation with Senator Cohen about kind of bumping a project like this up to the full finance committee, because it does, when it involves all of state government, it's not something that we can solve in our division.
Well, Senator Rust, you've got the bill that would bond for technology, so.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pappas, Representative Wagenius from the other body gave me a bill that I have introduced that specifically would allow under the Constitution bonding for technology systems, mm-hmm. not for the purchase of a computer, mm-hmm. but or anything that would have a minimal life span, but for the huge systems that we are now talking about putting in place centrally for our state. And I think that we always have been running into problems with the length of life of those systems when they're purchased, even if we know that they're going to last a long time because we can't afford to replace them, they nevertheless are not set up as, 20-year, mm-hmm. 20-year projects. But... if we put this amendment on the ballot in 2010, that would give us the flexibility in the future, and we are talking about long term here, but flexibility in the future to be able to consider, not just in the Finance Committee, but in capital investment, mm-hmm. the the prospect of being able to bond for integrated and complex technology systems at the state level.
But that doesn't do anything for this biennium.
I know, but you can only start where you are.
Okay. Any other questions on this one before we move on to e-licensing? Okay, Mr. Lally, did you want to move to the next topic?
Thank you, Senator. The electronic licensing system, just by way of background, currently Minnesota has about 300 professional and technical and business licenses that are administered within the executive branch. Now, we're not talking about driver and vehicle licenses, and we're not talking about recreational licenses like hunting and fishing and things like that. Each of those has their own systems either under development or in operation. This is looking at your license if you're a plumber, a realtor, any occupation licenses like that. If you're starting up a restaurant and you want to have access to all the licenses at the state level that you have to try to provide, currently you have to go to a variety of different agencies. Those 300 professional and technical and business licenses, which amount to about a half a million licenses a year that are issued to daycare providers and all the other people that are involved with this, vary wildly in the systems they use. Some have electronic systems to collect the information. Most of them don't have a true electronic licensing system where the rules for issuing a license are built in. They simply are a way of collecting the information to be processed online or offline and then result in the release of a license. Others are still highly manual systems where maybe something as simple as a spreadsheet that's used to keep track of how many licenses are issued. So it's a dramatic range of options that people have that are trying to collect those licenses. And they usually involve contacting multiple agencies. The concept underlying enterprise licensing is that there's a single portal that you go to. You identify the licenses that you need, regardless of what agency of state government may be administering them, and process them all at that one time. And do it 7x24 at your convenience, not when the state office happens to be open for you to come in and paperwork. It, in many cases, is paperwork, not electronic filing they're doing. So this is what we were trying to address in the electronic licensing system. You look at page 14, slide 27. What I've just described is what is captured in our project goal. When we started this initiative, when we started the planning for this initiative about 3.5 years ago, the goal was to set up one-stop online shopping for those licenses. We wanted to use the availability of the web both to support the users, the citizens trying to get their access, as well as the employees of the agencies using those same systems to judge whether a license should be issued when you have situations like academic requirements and other credentials that have to be considered. By creating a common application base for this that is web-based, so it's ubiquitous and available anywhere, and automated, and then can be customized at the interface to the individual agencies so that their processes and their requirements are respected, but yet instead of supporting hundreds of different applications individually, doing all the maintenance and the licensing and everything else that goes with that, you're supporting the one set of core logic and core capabilities, and then dealing with just the interfaces that are peculiar to a particular license type. There'd be a single point of entry, a single portal. You wouldn't have to be shopping around for state agencies to find out which ones have environmental or health or business registration or whatever. All of the different licenses could be handled through that same facility. It would be a very secure system, and this gets to some of Senator Limmer's questions, strong identity protection to make sure that the right people are getting the right kind of licenses with the proper authorization to do the things they want to do, so that we aren't turning people loose on an unsuspecting public with a license that they have no right to have. Since we came up with the original rationale and business case for this, which emerged out of Drive to Excellence initially and was further developed 4 years ago, a lot of things have changed in our environment. That's reflected in some of the ambiguity about what I'm going to tell you about how this will work and what it's going to cost, because the situation has changed dramatically for Minnesota's businesses and for all the people that hold these occupational licenses. And it's creating a significant amount of stress for them and some very practical problems for us in how we bring a system like this up. The concept remains the same. We can maximize the efficiency of the state's operations, provide the highest quality of service on a consistent basis to the most people, maximize the value that is given by taxpayer dollars if we can pull all of these things together. But it costs money to do. And what seemed to us the fairest system of doing this was to operate on a user fee basis. So the people that use the system pay for the cost of creating it, and ultimately down the road for the cost of operating it. We believe that some of the ease of operation, some of the reduction in the confusion for people that have to get multiple licenses by only going one place, defray some of the cost, because the cost of administering a state system is not just what it costs a state agency, it's what it costs the citizens. The cost of any kind of administration of a program has to look at what the impact is on the lives of the citizens that we are trying to serve. We also want to create the competitive environment in Minnesota where our regulation is as limited as possible, consistent with the goals of the program, and the cost of administering of those programs is kept as low as possible. And we think electronic licensing can do that. If you look at the map on page 29, the darker colored states are states that currently have e-government portals with electronic comprehensive electronic license capabilities. Minnesota is moving towards that, but we aren't there yet by any means. The majority of these states funded their e-licensing initiatives by user fees, just as we're proposing. It is the fairest way to try to get something like that established. In our project history, we've gone around and around on some of these issues because the impact of this on the citizen is a significant consideration for all of us. Somehow we have to find a way to make it economically feasible to put the system into place without it being so unduly burdensome that people can't afford the system that exists to serve them. On the other hand, in the current environment that we have, getting the full upfront funding, which is would have been our ideal 2 years ago, is probably even less feasible now, given the state's current situation, than it was 2 years ago. So do we give up a system that has the potential to make life a lot easier for a lot of people, deliver higher quality, and reduce the cost of those operations? We thought not. We thought we should progress with this, and that's why we're coming back. Initially, the Drive to Excellence program in e-licensing was set up to operate on a pilot project basis. We would bring up a couple of agencies, test the logic, prove the concept, and then begin to roll it out measured fashion to the rest of the executive branch agencies that issue licenses. The Department of Labor and Industry is the sponsoring agency. We're doing the legwork on managing this implementation for them. 2007, 2 years ago, you gave us $7.5 million to develop the infrastructure to support this e-licensing system and the security access software we need to control identity management, and also the money to begin rolling out that pilot project. There were two pilot agencies identified. First, one is the Post Board Peace Officer Standards and Training. There is the EMS Emergency Medical Services licenses. So far, as of the last reports that I've seen, over 1,000 transactions were successfully processed in the pilot process. It works as advertised. Now the issue is, how do we scale it upwards? How do we pay for the additional applications that are going to go on it? And what do we do as a funding model for this? And there have been a lot of issues around the funding model based on what's happened in the economy and what has happened with the candidate systems to go into this e-licensing environment. We did finish all the first steps that we had planned on 2 years ago. The environment is established. The secure environment is established. The platform for doing all this has been put into place and is operating. What happens to happen now is that you build successively with the other licenses so that we can run their individual operations on the state system and run efficiently and effectively. If you look at the slide on 32, it's slide 32 on page 16, that comparison at the beginning and now is really what we're trying to encapsulate here is the benefits of this system. Going from scattered licenses across many, many agencies, each with their own means of access, their own requirements for payment, their own methodology for collecting information, to one system that can be shared by many agencies, that could be accessible by all citizens whenever they want to do it. To go from processes that are intensely manual, paper-based processes in many agencies, to electronic processes, so that even if you have human intervention, you aren't pushing paper, you don't have all the non-productive time when paper is moved from one stack to another stack. Even when you're doing that kind of analysis, you're doing it on an electronic basis, which speeds up the process, and in the process increases the accuracy of the transactions. All of this is a benefit to the agencies, and it's a benefit to the citizens they serve. And we're still trying to pursue that in this process. However, we know that there are issues around this. Some of the things that we'd identified as being desirable to happen with the funding model haven't proven to be very satisfactory. And we've had to make a step backward looking at what that business case is going to be for getting the funding to do electronic licensing on a more comprehensive basis. All the benefits are there. But putting a surcharge, which is the user surcharge on the funding of this as a particular license migrates to the new system, is very controversial if the license itself has no charge, because then it's obviously to go from $0 to $10 may not be a huge issue for many people, but for some of the license holders, it adds to the burden of securing that license. So we're having to rethink some of the financial models around some of this. I'm going to skip over because I know we're running late on time.
And we do have somebody who wants to testify on e-licensing. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lally, what is a no-fee license? Could you give me some examples of what that may be?
I believe in the Department of Human Services they have licenses which are permissions to do business, but they don't charge for that license. That's a policy decision. For us to throw a surcharge on a no-fee license, creates all sorts of logical and practical problems for us to do that.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Tellmer.
And what are those licenses? What are those vocations that require a no-fee license?
I can get you a list. I don't have it at the tip of my fingers, I'm afraid.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lally, how many agencies are we talking? You said there were many, many agencies, to quote you. How many agencies are we really talking about that have licenses that people would have to scurry around to find?
Mr. Lally.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, of the state agencies, which includes all the small boards that are the primary licensing, there's more than 60 entities that issue licenses and over 300 licenses in total that are issued.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Limmer? In my business, I sometimes have to locate a contractor or a real estate company or a broker. I may not have a business address, so I'll call the respective agency, whether it's the Commerce Department or Department of Labor, and then they have subdivided in these agencies all of the licenses that are under their jurisdiction. And I didn't think there were 60 agencies that you had to look at to find a license. I thought it was maybe down to within maybe 3, 4, or 5, and then underneath that umbrella of those respective agencies, then you have the different licenses under, you know, listed according to profession.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, in many cases, these individual entities are not aggregated in a larger department. They have an independent existence, and their licensing authority is independent, and their operations are independent. That's why the number is as high as it is.
Mr. Chair, I didn't find a lot of difficulty in finding the licensed professionals when I just did Google searches. It seemed like it was pretty easy to find the organization that I needed to find. Finding the individual, on the other hand, after I knew their address or a business telephone number, got to be a little more difficult. But nevertheless, the information that I needed from state government that was public seemed to be fairly easy to get a hold of. But I haven't gone after the whatever the no-fee licenses are or the other licenses that I may not even know about yet. But
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, it's important to remember that many of these licenses are not simply a matter of maintaining a registry of people who practice. They have a lot of qualification issues and continuing education issues that they have to monitor very carefully to make sure that the professionals in these various areas are, in fact, competent to practice their profession in the state of Minnesota. And that's what takes a lot of the workflow underlying all of these licenses.
Mr. Chair, could you give me an example of some of these licensees that I just need to know an idea of? Who would be one of those that aren't under a separate agency that...
Mr. Lilly.
Mr. Chairman, I can tell you one, the State Board of Equalization that I am somewhat familiar with, which is the state board which oversees the certification of local assessors. And they have a certification requirement, a continuing education requirement, that the people that do these assessments must update on a regular basis, and it's tied into their professional accreditation. That system is administered on behalf of the State Board of Equalization by the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And it is one person that creates a database and keeps that database for that particular license application. You get into the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. My son is going to be a police officer, assuming he can find a job, when he graduates next month from college. He has to go to the post board and take the tests and maintain his certification and all the requirements as a police officer to be hired in the state of Minnesota. And there are myriad other examples of those small, individually important, but not large volume licensing authorities in Minnesota.
Okay. Did you want to finish up? And I'd like to bring in the testimony, those concerns on it at that breaking point. So do you have anything further on
the Mr. Chairman, probably the kernel of the proposal is on slide 36 on page 18. The preceding couple of pages I would hope you would go through because they're important to identify the benefits from this, but I understand the need to move on. The funding mechanism for this is a temporary 10% surcharge, which is a minimum of $10 on licenses that are issued or renewed for the agencies that are coming on board this system. Most of the licenses would be subject to a surcharge of from $10 to $50, depending on the cost of the license. Some of these are annual licenses. Some of them have longer periods where the license is valid, and obviously the fee would only be applied to the application and the renewal. The decision not to apply this to the no-fee licenses is a fairly recent one. It came about after this was drafted, and we're currently looking at the economic model to support e-licensing because obviously the costs have to be made up someplace, and that's what we're examining right now. It's a user fee, so it's not something we're putting on the systems now, and if you don't come on under this in your agency or if the customer doesn't deal with the new system for 5 years, they don't pay that fee in that agency until their licensing system comes on board. That's the way that we can have this reflect actual cost of migration. And the surcharge will be in operation for that agency for a six-year term. At the end of that six-year term, which covers installation, testing, and the first couple years of operation, the surcharge will click off, and at that point, then licensing fees are presumed with the efficiencies of the new licensing system to be adequate to cover the workflow and the staff to administer that licensing system.
Well, okay, so basically the surcharge is going to pay for the $4.7 million for the next, 6 years to pay for the system. That's how you're going to pay for it as opposed to any new money? Is that how it works?
Mr. Chairman, I wish I could answer that authoritatively, but we're still trying to figure out that business model with the changes that have just been made. And I don't think the final numbers are available yet.
But after 6 years, presumably you're still going to need to get new equipment and pay for things. So, I mean, you can blink it off, but then we're going to have to pay for the upkeep of the systems and so forth for some other way. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, that would typically be covered by the agency fees that are paid to run the system.
Okay.
Which would be in turn covered by the license fee itself. Right now, those license fees support a variety of manual and electronic processes. In the future, they would support primarily that state system plus whatever individual processes they have to use within the agency to attest to the continuing ed requirements or whatever else the requirements might be.
And on page 14 of the budget book, it does say that the alternative is to... We would not migrate these processes to the new system. It means everybody would do paper licensing, and in fact, even post board and EMS might have to return to the previous systems. Is that still current? Your analysis,
Mr. Chairman? Yes, that's my understanding. Okay. Somehow, right now, it would be exceedingly unfair to say that post and EMS have to pay the total operating cost of an environment designed to serve the entire state.
But if their authority was – their authority is just temporary. If that was continued just to, for those two agencies not expanded to anybody else, that would not necessarily mean they'd have to shut it down or what? I mean, this is only a pilot project for those two, right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, but the infrastructure was built in size to support the whole state.
Right.
What they were doing with the pilot project is testing the licensing logic that would go in to support those two agencies.
Okay.
And that's what has to be replicated for every other agency.
Okay. Do you have anything further that you want to discuss, Mr. Lally, on e-licensing?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any questions for the members? We did have somebody from the realtors who did want it, and I figured as long as we're on this topic now, maybe we can have that come forward. Let's see. Did we have Christine Berger? Yes. Please identify yourself for the record. And this is only on e-licensing. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christine Berger. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I really appreciate the opportunity to comment on the e-licensing today. We're just trying to learn as much as possible we can about this new system and educate the committee about an issue that we see as a problem that needs to be resolved. As you've heard, that there's going to be a potentially new electronic licensing system with a surcharge on all licensees in the state. And the problem we have with that is 2 years ago, with the help of Senator Olstein, who sits on the committee, and Senator Scheid, we passed and pursued with them legislation, supported it, to pay for a new licensing technology system through the Department of Commerce. And we pay $40 every time the licensees renew their license. They pay $40 for technology, e-technology. So we're paying $40 currently. We have learned that the Office of Enterprise Technology will be creating a one-stop portal or a homepage, if you will, where all licensees can find their respective license, click on their license, and then conduct their business. But what we've learned from the Department of Commerce is that once you click on that homepage, we're going to be rerouted back to the Department of Commerce into our current system. So we won't be receiving any other management and engineering and automate and so forth services, as far as we understand at this point. So that means that we'll be paying $10 for this portal page and then a total of $50 for e-licensing technology. We were being proactive by doing this 2 years ago, and my members feel that they're now being punished because of it. One option it would be to exempt us from the fee since we already are paying for the technology, or one could look up to Department of Commerce to find out if we really need to spend the $40. The legislation in 2007 said that we should that they can collect up to $40 for this e-technology. Whether they still need to collect the full 40 is a good question. Just a couple more questions. Would the other licensees not on the Department of Commerce, the system being Would they pay $10 for the entire system, so the entire structure behind the portal too, the entire licensing section of it? Or would they have it like us, where it's you're rerouted back to your own agency? And then would the Office of Enterprise Technology have any regulatory functions over real estate licensees, insurance agents, appraisers, and so forth? And I think that concludes my comments. Thank you.
And as you know, there's no specific proposal before us yet, but as you know, as the details start coming forward, I would hope that you and OET, you know, can discuss this so that maybe you can come up with some resolution so you don't have to pay the fee twice and do, you know, a two-stop shopping or whatever. So, okay?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the department have any answers to give to the real estate trade regarding the questions that they brought up?
Mr. Lally?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, I have answers to some of them. I'm not sure I could track all of them, but I'll try to respond to them. The easiest one is the last one. We will not have any purview over the agency licensing. What their licensing requirements are and approvals and all that is not a matter of technology. It's a matter of the business side of the enterprise. In terms of the system that was put into place 2 years ago, at that time when we reviewed that system, because we're required to review any new system that's proposed, we asked the Department of Commerce, or told the Department of Commerce, the e-licensing initiative was part of the governor's package, and it would be inconsistent for them to go and develop something off to the side when the statewide system is coming in. And we were assured at that point, as a matter of fact, it was written in their RFP, that when the statewide system came on board, the Department of Commerce would migrate the real estate licensing system to the new system. As to whether and how much of the supporting logic is transferred over to the Department of Commerce, part of that is their decision. But I want to remind you that we are the interface into the licensing function of the agencies. We don't replace all of the licensing logic as part of the main system. Each agency has to decide what their operating processes and workflows are going to be. So I can't really address that. The issue of whether the surcharge should be paid by the realtors or not is part of that discussion I mentioned. We're looking at the business model again to try to identify both the changing economic times and increased knowledge that we've acquired over the last couple of years. Does that model have to be adjusted? It may well have to be adjusted, but we're not in a position to comment on that right now.
That's true. Senator Limmer.
Is it the intent of your department to charge Department of Commerce licensees that are paying more money now for this two-year-old system to reduce that fee to $10 across the board if this request was issued? Or would it be a fee on top of the existing fee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, that's what we're looking at right now, trying to figure out how we make this model work equitably, but so that we get the system as much as possible funded by the users of the system.
Mr. Chair, 2 years ago when that then new system was designed, what agency requested it? Was it Commerce or was it your office? What agency requested and
Mr.
created it?
Chairman, Hello? Senator Limmer, the proposal for the standalone system came from the department issuing the licenses. It was made to us as part of the review process of systems. And their concern was that it would be several years under our model before they would be covered by the system, and that their needs were so urgent and the condition of their existing operation simply would not allow them to wait 3 or 4 years for a new system to reach them. And that was the agreement. We would let them go ahead under that basis.
Mr. Lally, do you recall how much that system cost 2 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. But I guess I'm kind of confused. We have a department wanting it perhaps as a stopgap measure until something else came along. The licensees have to pay a a rather pricey premium as compared to what you're offering today. And your agency didn't want them to do that. Is that correct in what you told us earlier?
Mr. Chairman, under ideal circumstances, we would use the one system for all licensees. Different agencies were in different positions at that time. Commerce is one example of that. They simply did not feel they could wait for the state system to come along. It was a simple business decision on their part that they needed to proceed with it, but with the understanding that they would, the approach that was going to be taken from an enterprise level would apply to commerce as well. Now, again, where the logic, the computer logic, switches off from the state system to the local system, I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I don't know what the expectation is there.
Mr. Chair,
sure.
On this request, the one that we were talking of for the Office of Enterprise Technology, that was a governor's initiative. And then the e-licensing that I see, I think that was considered a governor's initiative as well. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, when the Commerce Department came forward, was that a governor's initiative as well? And now we're in conflict with one another. You see where I'm going on this?
Mr. Chairman, I simply don't know what the status of that proposal was 2 years ago. I simply don't recall. Whether it was packaged like this is as a governor's initiative, I suppose by implication anything in the governor's budget is a governor's initiative. But they were requesting that as a result of a several year study of their internal operations. And
yeah. I guess I'm confused on it because it's 2 years ago some agency had to come here, sell us on the idea to get this system going for commerce. Mm-hmm. It became law, it was signed into law, and now we're reinventing the system. Somewhere I can't help but think that there's some waste that occurred by the 2 year stopgap, and now we're trying to get this global idea of having this one stop shop thing.
Well, as I recall, and maybe I can ask our staff to refresh my memory, but I mean, the proposal for relicensing was here before us 2 years ago, before our budget division, and you know, we just didn't have the money for it. But we, you know, they stressed, and the administration was stressing that they felt it was important enough. So we did start it on a temporary basis, and that's why we had the, you know, the surcharges saying, well, if you want to collect the money for the licensing, I mean, you know, we wouldn't have the funding to build this thing, but we can start collecting some fees and doing it with some tests as a pilot project. That's about as far as we're going to go. So that part got going, and maybe that's where the commerce just spun off in a different direction. I don't know. Does Mr. Lundin or Mr. Lamar, do you remember anything different as to how we handled this here?
Well, 2 years ago when we funded it, it wasn't a licensing surcharge. It was a direct appropriation
that
we gave. There was a proposal last session about doing a surcharge, but that didn't end up in the final legislation.
Okay.
And we were charged to come back this year with a business model to support it ongoing.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay, Sir Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lundin, do you remember what the cost was on the system for commerce?
I'd have to go back and check. I don't know right offhand. Right.
Okay. Could you provide that to Sir Limmer?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Anything further on e-licensing? We've got one more topic on IT security here. Nothing. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lally. I guess Mr. Boozy was going to be telling us the rest. Okay. Mr. Boozy, welcome back to the Budget Division. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Christopher Boozy. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota.
And on pages 34 to 38 of the budget books of the OET, that's where this area is. Mr. Boozy.
Thank you very much. Before I start, the purpose of my presentation, I'm going to be short. I want to talk about what has been done with the Enterprise Security Program since we got started a little more than 2 years ago today. Actually, primarily I'd like to talk about the return on investment that our government gets for having the Enterprise Security Program, and actually you in particular, since you're one of the bodies that actually listened to the testimony and made the decision to appropriate the dollars to have an enterprise security program. As you heard from the initial testimony, the enterprise security program and actually enterprise security in general is an extremely high priority of our state, and in particular with our state chief information officer. As he testifies before the legislature and around the country, Gopal Khanna always talks about security being number one, particularly building a secure infrastructure. So with that said, what I'd like to do is start off by talking about where we started and where we are today. When we started a little over 2 years ago, we really had a security world where every agency acted completely independent of any other agency. Staff did the best that they could with the resources that were available. However, what we found is that the problems that agencies faced, and actually still face today, were simply too complicated and too costly to solve on an agency-by-agency basis. Since that time, I think we have a pretty good story to tell. OET now provides enterprise leadership services for information security, and one of the things that I think works very well for us is we've formed and we have a very active statewide information security council and a security community. In fact, every month we meet for several hours. We have subcommittees that are working committees of the council, and we have at least 50 organizations that participate in the Enterprise Security Council. Essentially, I look at them as being basically the board of directors for enterprise security. Everything that happens, they should agree it's the right thing for us to do, and every dollar that we spend, I feel like we're accountable to make sure that we use those dollars prudently to address our most strategic problems. We're also one of the select few states in the country that has actually put together a detailed enterprise security strategic plan. It's a 5-year roadmap of how we bridge the gap from where we are today to where we hope to be down the road. We have a program foundation that's set, and we're developing a series of policies and standards that set the baseline for the government as a whole. And finally, I wanted to make sure when I took this job that we weren't just a blind policy office. I wanted to make sure that along with helping define the bar for agencies, that we actually put in place real security solutions as well that agencies could use to, in fact, be more secure. As you look down to slide 40, I've listed a couple different things to demonstrate some of the things that we're doing and the value of the Enterprise Security Program. As you can see, I've organized things in two categories. There's a lot of non-technical work that we do, but there's also a lot of technical work. So I wanted to just talk about a couple different things on this slide to kind of give you a flavor of some of the things that we're doing. When we look at things from the non-technical perspective, one of the things that we've spent a lot of time on is trying to help develop policies, standards, and joint solutions for the government as a whole. One of those solutions that I think has been really important for us is we've really worked hard on addressing the issue with portable computing device security. Most of the issues that you read about in the news today when you hear about security breach deal with laptop thefts and data lost on laptops. One thing that you don't hear when you listen to the news is you don't hear a lot of stories about the state of Minnesota agencies. One of the reasons why that is because when we first started about 2 years ago, one of the first tactical problems that we addressed is portable computing device security, and we worked very hard as a community to develop standards for how we secure portable computing devices, and we were one of the first states in the nation that actually adopted an enterprise-wide strategy for securing portable devices. In fact, to date, we partner with a company called PointSec that provides our technology, and we've purchased about 25,000 licenses for portable computing devices across the state of Minnesota. And one of the success stories there is we have had thefts of devices that have sensitive data on those devices, but we don't have to do breach notification because we're confident that the data that's on those devices cannot be accessed because of the solutions that we have in place. So that's one of the examples. We also do quite a bit of training, and we do a lot of direct consulting for agencies. We worked with the legislature when it was trying to put together a wireless infrastructure. Our biggest project to date is we're just wrapping up a major assessment of the Veterans Affairs Department after some of the security breaches that the agency was in the news and they had some embarrassments. We helped them do a comprehensive assessment of their department to help them improve their controls. On the technical side, We're putting in a lot of different solutions to help prevent bad things from happening and to detect situations a lot more promptly than we've been able to do in the past. The one that that I'm most proud of is the Enterprise Vulnerability and Threat Management System. That is one solution that we've built out centrally, and the premise behind it is that through technical means, we do ongoing scanning and assessment of all IT assets across the entire government. We also partner with MinSCU. The plan as we roll out this solution completely will be that we will assess, we estimate about 150,000 computers on an ongoing basis trying to find vulnerabilities and fix them before they're exploited by hackers. As a service to all OET customers, and not just customers in the executive branch, whether it's school districts that are OET customers, counties, cities, every customer that is a customer of OET, we also provide ongoing scanning of all of their external websites and all of their services on a monthly basis as well. So it's just a few examples of some of the kind of things that we're doing on the technical and the non-technical basis. The list is actually quite long, but I thought I would just give you a few things on the slide to get a flavor of what we're doing. To refresh your memory on the funding behind the Enterprise Security Program, in our initial startup years, which actually end June 30 of this year, you appropriated about $5.9 million for us. It's actually $5.7 million this year after some reductions that were made through some special laws. But ongoing with fiscal year 10 on forward, our base for the Enterprise Security Program is approximately $4.3 million. That funding primarily pays for the costs of the large statewide systems. So, for example, the enterprise-wide system to do vulnerability and threat management, something that we felt was desperately needed in our government. The cost of that solution is approximately $800,000 to $900,000 a year. I think the key point, though, of having the solution that includes the staffing, the hardware, the software, is that we buy and we build this service once, and we use it to provide ongoing assessments to the entire executive branch of government, and then on the external side, to all customers that use OET services. So that the numbers sound high for these types of solutions, we actually build them and deploy them once, and they're shared by every government agency. So that's the value proposition that we have today. We also provide risk management services, consulting. We help agencies with incident response, forensics, continuity of operations planning, and just ongoing security consulting as well. So in conclusion, when we talk about the ROI or the return on investment for security, one case that I wanted to talk about that was recently in the news dealt with the Moundsview school computers. I'm not sure if everybody has heard about this case, but for approximately 2 weeks, I believe that they're now ending in the ending stages of this particular incident, they had a very serious computer virus outbreak in the school district. And in fact, the school district has been without computer support for about 2 weeks, impacting about 3,500 computers. Very serious issue. But one of the things that really, it's heartbreaking for me as a state CISO, is that when I look at a case like this, this is the kind of case that's entirely preventable. And in fact, with our Enterprise Vulnerability and Threat Management Program, the exploit that underlied this particular incident that happened was something that came out in October. And it was a technical technical exploit that came out in October, but the value of having an enterprise program that really watches everybody's back is that as soon as we learned about this, we immediately went out and we tried to figure out what are the right mitigation strategies. And that very same day, we contacted all the executive branch agencies, told them what they needed to do, worked with the Information Security Council on how they needed to update their systems to prevent these type of situations from happening. But then we also took the Enterprise Vulnerability and Threat Management System, the technical solution as well, and we put in place what we call scan profiles so that when our customers actually go out and scan their systems, if they didn't update their systems correctly and they didn't apply the proper patches to their systems, they would know about it through our technical solution as well. So this particular virus, it didn't just hit Moundsville. It hit millions and millions and millions of computers around the world. But I was very happy that there was very, very minimal damage to the executive branch of government. And that is one of the things that really shows the true value proposition of having an enterprise program where we have one really good function that helps watch everybody's back. We share resources from the people side, from the tool side, but ultimately the goal here, which is the true value proposition, is we want to have fewer incidents than we have today, and we want to have less damaging security incidents by trying to find and fix issues before they get exploited, and putting in place a lot of proactive security controls as well. For example, as we build out a new accounting and procurement system, we want to make sure that we're in upfront, helping make sure that they use security architecture as a defense when they build new systems. Finally, one of the areas that we're addressing as well along on the ROI front is trying to make our environment more able to withstand damaging situations in the continuity of operations area, something that definitely goes on par with the data center consolidation. I think the way I'd like to describe it is when you look at IT today, complexity is the enemy. So whatever we do to simplify our environment, to standardize, and to share resources really is going to go a long way to making our government more secure. And so with that, I'd be open to answer any questions that you may have on where we are today with the security program.
Mr. Boozy, I've got a question or two. I'm just trying to track. I mean, maybe I'm not looking at the right budget page here, but on page 38, it talks about enterprise IT security, and it actually shows an increase there in FTEs and an increase in the funding. You had a big spike in 09, which, you know, we provided for, and then it goes from 6 million to 6.4. But and where in the budget books does it talk about this reduction of $600,000 and a reduction of four FTEs? Where is that showing up for your reductions? As I say, I don't know if you got the budget books there before you, but I'm looking at IT security, and it looks like it actually increases as opposed to what the slide says.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe that there's going to be some testimony coming up right after this that talks about on the general impact of the budget cuts to enterprise, to OET as a whole. One of the decisions that was made was that the budget cuts that all agencies were expected to take, that there would not be cuts on the enterprise security program because we're in a build-out stage right now. Okay. So I believe that addresses one of your questions. The other question about when you look at the spikes that appear, one of the reasons why the spikes are there is when we first started up the program and got going in fiscal year 08, we actually we're funded for the biennium. A lot of the big dollar value purchases that we're making in the startup phase of our program, we actually strategically made decisions to carry forward the money into the second year of the biennium for spending. So overall, the appropriations were 5.9 and 5.7 for both of those years, and that's what the total should show for our spending authority. Money was carried over from the first year of the biennium to the second. One of the issues that we undoubtedly faced as a brand new function is in the first year, we were spending a lot of time getting the policy pieces in place, and we spent quite a bit of time actually hiring the staff that we have on today to do a lot of the work that needs to be done.
Okay. Well, is there somebody here who can explain slide 45 and what that actually means? I'm not quite sure where those four full-time equivalents and the $600,000 is coming from and where it is.
Mr. Chair, John Lally, okay, or Larry Freund will take that after the security.
And Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to understand in this, you know, technology and I don't get along so well, so I always have questions on the security. When you talk about this build-out, help me to understand just a snapshot of equipment versus if people are constantly coming up with new security threats and new viruses, what's the difference between the equipment build-out and then having people stay ahead of the security threats? I'm not really tracking with that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, all of the tools and processes that we're putting in place, we're really trying to stay ahead of the strategic curve. So when we craft particular security solutions, I'll use enterprise vulnerability and threat management, for example. We have a team of five individuals that help support that solution enterprise-wide, and those individuals are responsible for using the technology but also trying to make sure that we do stay ahead of the curve. So, for example, the tool that we use as part of our solution, it's called IP360 from N-Circle Network Technologies. And what that team does is we're actually out there proactively watching what happens on a day-to-day basis. So in the vulnerability world, on a typical day, we have probably 50 new computer vulnerabilities that come out on an average day today. The reason why we partner with the vendor is because they update the tools and they try to keep the tools up to date to make sure that when agencies use the tools that we provide them, their scans and the work that they do actually shows the problem so that they can be found and remediated promptly. However, one thing that's important to keep in mind is that most of the tools that are out there today, and they're called signature-based tools, whether it's an antivirus product or something complex like our vulnerability management system, have a lag period in those tools. And that lag period today can range anywhere from 2 days to a week. And that can actually be a lethal period of time with how fast some of the viruses propagate today. So what we do from a threat dissemination perspective is because we do ongoing scanning and remediation through this process, we basically are putting ourselves in a position where we know all the different technology that runs across the government. So as soon as some problem comes out in the wild, whether it's a Microsoft vulnerability or with some Novell operating system or whatever the case may be, we know that our tool sets are going to have a lag in detecting that. So we go out to the agencies, we contact them, and we immediately let them know that we know that you're running this particular database management system. There is a new exploit. Here's what you need to do to fix that. So the people partner with the tools to make it a holistic vulnerability and threat management program. The tool helps cover us long-term and make sure that our systems are patched and remediated. But the people actually provide that immediate notification to the agencies, and they cover that weak gap so that we don't have a problem that infects the entire government in the first week. So we try to get it out there and meet with the people immediately to address the security issues. Did that answer your question?
No, Sam Jungbauer did it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Woozy, I think it did, but just to make sure, then what you're saying is this will always be a fairly labor-intensive, person-intensive type of situation?
Mr. Chair, committee members, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. We're running towards the end when we're going to have to give up the room, so can I find out a little bit more about what the proposal is and get a better explanation on slide 45 as to what this reduction actually represents? Where is that coming out of? What is it going to mean?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If you look at slide 44 very quickly, our total budget, 92% of it is rate-based. It's paid by other agencies for us to provide specific services. Only 8% of our total budget is categorized as general fund. It's appropriated by the legislature to OET. And that 8% is largely made up of two primary components. Security has a general fund component that's been funded by appropriation, as well as a part that's funded by rates. And then the remaining part, that 2% of the general fund basic appropriation, covers the oversight functions in the Office of State's CIO, and that includes planning, portfolio management, the project oversight functions, and some of the communications and related functions of OET. So we're taking a $606,000 reduction, our proportional 5% base level reduction. But the governor's proposal is in accordance with our recommendation that we ought to keep security protected from that reduction, so it comes out of enterprise planning and oversight. It will result in the elimination of four FTEs. One of those is a currently vacant position that we use for interns and student workers and people like that. We simply will not be able to fill that. Two of the positions and part of the remaining are going to be from reductions within that planning and oversight function. One of them is covered by a retirement that's imminent this summer, and the other one we're still looking at how that's going to be managed. It would be managed either by attrition or by layoff or by finding an alternative funding source for that particular process. And we are looking at how do we continue the portfolio management and the project oversight and planning functions with that staff reduction that the budget requires, and looking at a number of creative alternatives for that.
Well, I'm looking at page 29 of the budget books. It does show going from 32 FTEs in 08 to 42 in 09 and then down to 38 in 10 and 11. I mean, so that accounts for the four positions. I'm still trying to figure out where does a $600,000 cut show up within the budget books that we've got from the administration.
I need a doctor.
Yeah, Mr. Lindeen, could you help me on this one?
Chairman, I think our CFO would be the best person
okay.
to answer that.
Okay, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record, and we are almost out of time. So,
Mr. Chair, my name is Larry Freund. I'm the CFO for Office of Enterprise Technology. If you look on page 8, that shows the $303,000 reduction towards the top of the middle of the page there in the budget book.
Right.
Page 8 of the budget book. That shows the $303,000 per year reduction.
And what does the line say? Where
Operating budget under change items, operating okay. budget reduction.
Okay.
But then if you go where it shows, actually shows, or you don't see the $303,000, but if you go to page 29,
okay.
the general fund appropriation on that page there, that's the reduction is taken, and the result is that $1,495,000 is the new base for this part of the operation for enterprise planning and management. So that's where the reduction shows up.
And then what ultimately does this mean, you know, for the office? I mean, what can't you do, or what's it going to mean? So,
Mr. Chair, that was what John had just talked about there. It basically reduces two in John's area of planning and management. And there's, like you said, too, there was a vacancy for student workers. There's actually two vacancies for student workers. And then we also had a clerical position that we had held open for some other, as we were going through this change process, but we decided not to fill that position permanently here. So that's another position that we're not filling. So that comes up with the four positions that we're reducing.
Okay, but those four positions cost more than $600,000, didn't it, or did it?
No, the student workers are at a much reduced rate, so those were, but they're still considered FTE, but they're at a much lower rate, and then also the position for the clerical support was only a 0.75 position.
Okay, so the agency is able to absorb the $600,000 cut. Is that?
That's what we're doing. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? Members, this concludes it for today. We're not going to be meeting Wednesday. There's going to be a lot of activity and a lot of budget issues over the next day or two, so we didn't want to add to confusion. Starting next Monday, we're actually going to be hearing some bills because we've got some bills that are in the Finance Committee. We're trying to schedule those for hearings so we can start making decisions and recommendations on that. So unless there's anything further before the Budget Division, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Will not be here next Monday.